Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today on the podcast, we will discuss a phenomenal new edited volume entitled New Perspectives on the Black Intellectual Tradition. And so this book is actually published by our friends at Northwestern University Press. And New Perspectives was edited by a phenomenal editorial team headed by Drs. Keisha Blaine, Ashley Farmer, and Christopher Cameron. To represent the editorial team is none other than a good friend of mine, Dr. Ashley Farmer. Welcome to the show, Dr. Farmer. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me again.
Yeah. You know, as you were saying offline, you know, it's been about a year. I remember I actually recorded in the basement of the African Meeting House.
Oh.
So I actually recorded it from there. My mother was in town after seeing me do my, you know, thesis discussion at Simmons College. And now I am back in sunny and warm Florida, whereas last year it was very much snowy in Boston.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and like I said before, what a difference a year makes.
Mm-hmm.
Most definitely. And so before we get into the text, you know, this is an important edited volume that took three phenomenal minds to bring together along with Northwestern University Press. But it's also largely indebted to your phenomenal organization, the African American Intellectual History Society. So can you inform us, you know, especially for those who surprisingly enough are not aware of the full awesomeness of the organization that which you work with? Can you inform us about AIHS and a brief history of how the organization was founded?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of what makes AIHS interesting or different is that it's a relatively new organization run by mostly all junior scholars. So the goal of the organization is to kind of foster dialogue, whether that be about researching, teaching, archival work, the profession, et cetera, about Black thought and culture. So our history really began in early 2014 when Chris Cameron, one of the editors of New Perspectives of the Black Intellectual Tradition, founded the organization. And originally, it was founded as an online blog only to bring scholars together. And Chris went around finding who he thought were some of the folks doing new and innovative work in Black intellectual history. He also worked very hard to make sure that he really covered, or the blog really covered, a spread both kind of time period and geographic areas based on people's expertise. And it started out with a kind of a collective of folks blogging once a month about Black intellectual history. And by December of that year in 2014, it had a roster of about 20 regular bloggers. So it was already putting up content on the blog almost every day, or every day and so. So the following year, seeing the interest that was being garnered from the blog and conversations amongst some of the bloggers and other folks about the desire to kind of have something that was more than just the blog, they became incorporated as a 501c3 organization. So Chris Cameron started as the president, Keisha Blaine, who's another one of the great editors, I was the secretary, and I was the treasurer and remain the treasurer to this day. And since then, we have held, let's see, we're on our, I think, fourth conference coming up in March of 2019. And also, we have expanded beyond the blog to be able to offer book prizes, article prizes, the CLR James Fellowship, which helps fund research in Black intellectual history for both graduate students and senior scholars, and Black Perspectives, the blog that was originally started back in 2014, has really proliferated, and we have way more folks writing for it. We have a whole book review section, and we also do fantastic roundtables, sometimes on a book or sometimes on a particular idea or person.
Outstanding. And, you know, it's so interesting. I've been acquainted, some buddies of mine and I have really been following for a good while now. And so it was phenomenal to see on the schedule that the past year's conference was at Brandeis, so in Boston. And so we didn't necessarily have to travel far. You know, it's out of Boston for those who are in, you know, who are aware of Boston. It's definitely outside of the bubble, and outside of normal transit lines. But you know, still relatively, you know, obviously close. Yeah, not too far. And so being able to see everybody that I've been reading about and seeing their work was so tremendous. And also why I am so proud to tell my mother and everyone else that I can that I am a member and a writer for such a phenomenal academic blog and a part of a great organization. And so I also saw, I guess it would have been earlier this year, about this phenomenal edited volume. And I knew immediately that once that text came out, I had to get, you know, some of y'all and on the program to chat about it. And so I was so happy when you elected to come on the program, because, you know, after reading the text, and you might have seen my fun reaction video after seeing it on Twitter, that I was very much excited to not only receive the book but also to read it. And I would say that after reading it, the reaction on the video is how I felt internally after reading it, for sure.
Well, that's good news then. Hopefully more people feel the same after reading it.
Oh yeah, most definitely. And so with that as well, you know, considering that this is an edited volume, you know, so a collaborative project, can you tell us a bit about, you know, how long ago the concept was really, you know, founded for this edited volume as well?
Yeah. So the edited volume came out of the 2016 conference. So as I said, in 2014, we started the blog. Mainly Chris started the blog. By 2015, we were a larger organization that was accepting memberships. And 2016 is the first time we held what is now our annual conference. And so we had a couple of publishers ask us if we would like to basically develop an edited collection or an anthology based on some of those papers that were presented for the collection. And we thought this was a good idea for a couple of reasons. One, really, even from the get-go, even though the conference has only gotten better and better, even in that first conference, it really was a very dynamic group of scholars that were really pushing the boundaries of, we thought, how people do Black intellectual history, how people think of folks as a Black intellectual and kind of what they define as Black thought. And secondly, we thought it would be a great way to start to establish these conferences as spaces that were not only for people to try out new ideas, but that could eventually become, you know, kind of publications that they could put on their CV and reach a wider audience. So once we chose a publisher, let's see, that was about 2016, we asked folks, or, you know, kind of sent out a call for those who might want to participate in it. And, you know, this is always a little bit of a give and take based on everybody's schedules, who is available to participate in it, how far along was what they presented or what they're writing about in conference form, and, you know, can they shape it into a chapter? One of the things that I think that we did with this volume, and I should mention that there's another volume following this based on the conference in Nashville as well, that another set of editors from AIHS are publishing. But a common thing that we do when we write these volumes or create these volumes is try to have a moment where we get all of the authors together to workshop their papers and present their papers. And we do this for a couple of reasons. One, you know, it's just nice to foster the community. One of the things that AIHS is great about is fostering community amongst young scholars, but also it gives the editors and the contributors a moment to kind of dialogue and have feedback before the deadline so that they can kind of make adjustments. And often for this particular volume, we held it at University of Pennsylvania. The last one for the next volume was held at the University of Oregon. But it really just gives an opportunity to kind of work on these contributions as work in progress, which we think helps it become a better and stronger anthology and a more even anthology. So after folks wrote the first draft, they workshopped it. And then after that, they had time to write the final draft. So with all editing processes, it takes a very long time. You got to multiply that at least by two, if not three, for an edited volume, because there's so many different contributors and everybody has got to be, peer reviewed, then edited, then copy edited before it can become publication. So it takes several years to get such a volume as this into print. However, we definitely think it was worth it. It really does have a collection of really the newest and brightest scholars in the field. And it really does cover a diverse range of ideas about Black thought and how ideas travel.
And with that as well, I'm so, as I have said on tremendous amount of occasions, it's very interesting. And actually you took one of my next questions. I was going to ask you about that as well, because I was going to ask, why now for New Perspectives, and obviously you answered that. But as a second part of it, as you said, pretty much everybody involved in this project, from editors to contributors, are either junior scholars or fairly fresh in the process. And so I thought about as well, what kind of void do you think that that New Perspectives on the Black intellectual tradition is filling? Because it's interesting too, who blurbed the book, right? On the very back, you have none other than the person who's probably written 3,005 books in his entire life, being Gerald Horn, right? So someone, so you have on the front, the new guard, and then you have someone who's, of the older guard as well with Horn. So I think it's a really interesting mix as well. So can you tell us a bit about what you all believe to be the void in the scholarship that new Perspectives is filling?
Yeah, so one of the things that New Perspectives is filling, we should think of New Perspectives as kind of, for lack of a better word, a brick and mortar version of kind of what we're trying to do at AIHS online more broadly. So we really wanted, one of the things that all of us as young scholars were seeing is that, one, a lot of folks that are working on Black thought, Black intellectualism, Black thinkers, are kind of disparate. There might be one person working on it in terms of, religious thinkers, another person's working on it in terms of what it means to think about fugitivity, another person like me is thinking about it in terms of Black women and Black power. So one of the just kind of more obvious voids that it fills is it just helps readers get all this information succinctly and all together. It helps us foreground all those folks who are already doing that kind of work by bringing it together and talking about it. So that's one void that it fills, just kind of that kind of collective gathering of minds and writing and ideas. The second is, really Black intellectual history is going through, I think, a renaissance. There is a very kind of a spike in increased interest in it, and also an interest in kind of pushing it back against what people generally think of as who gets to be an intellectual and what counts as intellectualism and kind of how ideas circulate. You're starting to see scholars across the board go back to sources that we've revisited a lot and rethink how we might understand them as forms of ideas traveling or thought information. And so a number of the pieces in this collection are really seeking to fill the void of who else is a Black thinker besides the big names that we know, besides the Frederick Douglass, besides the Phyllis Wheatley, besides the Malcolm X, besides the MLK. What other folks are talking about thought, what other folks are theorizing, and how does that shape how we understand Black history? And I think finally, it's also just trying to fill the void that Black intellectual history doesn't permeate all aspects of Black life. And I mean that both in terms of, the secular, the sacred, in terms of the grassroots, in terms of the top down, but also in terms of geographical diversity. Our focus, or kind of the historiography's focus in the past on a few big name figures, has led us to overlook a lot of this. So, you know, I think bringing the scholarship together, challenging who gets to be an intellectual, what counts as intellectualism, and really diversifying what that means are kind of three of the main goals of the book and some of the ways it helps bridge some of the gaps in the historiography.
That's awesome. And so I'm really excited because, you know, after reading New Perspectives, and it's so awesome too to see the work that many of if I'm not mistaken, if I'm sifting through it now and reading the names, if I'm not mistaken, all of the contributors are actual members of the organization, correct? Or at least very much involved in writing posts for Black Perspectives, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they would either be folks, the most folks who are the contributors are either regular bloggers or were regular bloggers at one time, have certainly been guest bloggers, and are certainly all members of the organization. And so it creates kind of this wonderful reciprocity, right? You may have come in blogging or may have come in through the conference, but now through communing with other scholars, through getting feedback with other scholars, not only do you have just an actual real life community of, you know, those engaged in understanding Black thought, you've also got a space to really hone in your ideas and publish those ideas for a wider audience with support of the organization. So one of the things that I really, really like about AIHS and in this volume in particular is that it kind of gives back to bloggers and gives back to members what they're giving the organization itself. You know?
Mm-hmm. And I really like that because what it is doing is that, you know, there are folks like myself who are graduate students or PhD students who are involved. And so I think like it's a really nice meshing organizationally and also looking towards the future of different, you know, because I can only imagine like this, you even dropped some knowledge bomb on me about some future volumes that are going to be building up. And so I'm sure like this is only the beginning for, you know, the kind of, you know, edited volumes, anthologies that the organization is going to be producing. But it also, for me, makes me think about you have folks who are fairly new and you have people in the organization who are graduate students. So it provides a lot of different hands who are coming from different institutions, right? We're not all, you know, a lot of folks are coming from, you know, you have a group from HBCUs you have folks who are from, you know, Ivy League universities, you have small liberal arts colleges. So I like it because it provides a lot of different areas that people can engage with. And also, you know, can you tell us too on that note, because your four essential themes are Black internationalism, religion and spirituality, racial politics and struggles for social justice, and Black radicalism. Can you speak to us about how you all came to those particular themes for the collection?
Yeah. Before I did that, I want to, you know, just kind of second your point about kind of the range of folks involved. I mean, one of the ways also that the volume is groundbreaking is that, like you said, there's a range of intellectuals writing this, right? So you're also kind of challenging who gets the authority with which to write these things from both the junior scholar level and kind of the diversity of institutional level as well. As far as the sections, some of this has to do with our own interest. I mean, you'll certainly see, you know, Keisha works a lot on Black internationalism. I work a lot on Black, you know, Black radicalism and racial politics for social justice. Chris works quite a bit on, you know, religion and spirituality and secularism in particular. So some of that is our own interest, but also some of it is about spaces in which we thought we could push the boundaries of intellectual history further, you know? Often, particularly in something like internationalism or religion and spirituality, there's no shortage of scholarship about Black people in these fields, but usually it's more about what they're doing than what they're thinking. And so some of that was a way to consciously push back or kind of broaden these themes of Black history that we know so well by showing the intersections of the existing historiography and the very new work that's being done in intellectual history on that part. So the next volume will vary up in the theme slightly as well, so that we continue to cover the spread. But it really was a choice of, you know, some of our interests, but also where do we think some of the best interventions were poised to be made in historiography, kind of what subject area.
Outstanding. And as well, because I hear us all like constantly going back to the marginalization of really, you know, black people in general, as far as who gets to be an intellectual. So can you touch on your feelings about, you know, your thoughts about this particular subject of, you know, why the marginalization happens and why we hone in so much on a very, very narrow scope on who gets to be an intellectual?
Yeah, you know, some of it I think is just the approach to history in general, typically of any subject, right? Not just intellectual history, not even just African-American history, is usually a top-down approach. And it's also often usually driven by things that we have sources for, which leads us to organizations or perhaps leaders who were so well known in the community that their speeches, their writings, et cetera, have been collected, anthologized, and saved. So some of it is that. And I also do think, though, that there is this persistent notion that an intellectual is solely somebody who is usually a man and usually is the most popular within a given moment. And that's not necessarily, they're not mutually exclusive. We're just arguing that in that focus, we're kind of overlooking or over, this focus has overshadowed all the other ways in which people are thinking and doing and discussing how their ideas about the world come into being. So again, a little bit of just kind of always the top-down focus, a little bit of sources and what's available. But one of the ways in which I think all of these all of the contributions in the volume are pushing back is a discussion kind of not only about what counts as intellectual history or an intellectual, but the kinds of sources they're using to do their intellectual history. I think we're seeing a new push within scholarship, not simply in African-American intellectual history, but certainly in it, to challenge what constitutes a source for intellectualism. And so you will see some folks reading what we would think is traditional sources, such as speeches, pamphlets, treatises, right? But you'll also see folks reading much more kind of grassroots level exchanges, whether that be handbooks, whether that be posters that were, you know, put up on a tree, whether that be someone's own kind of inner dialogue about their religious practices. So our hope is that we can kind of expand what that kind of top-down, you know, kind of limited source approach to Black intellectuals.
Yeah, and I remember this, even, I think it was it a year ago that you were on the, Conversations in Black Freedom Studies at the Schomburg with Dr. Jean Theo Harris, Dr. Cobb? Was that,
You know, I think it was Charles Payne.
Charles Payne, there we go. Dr. Payne. Yeah, Dr. Payne and Gloria Richardson as well, because y'all were talking about the legacy of, you know, an important 20th century intellectual being Fannie Lou Hamer, because it would have been her 100th birthday, right? Because to me, when I think about, you know, what you just spoke about, you know, expanding the notion of who gets to be an intellectual, if we're not including, if your definition or the people that you're talking about of Black intellectual history and the black intellectual tradition, I feel that if you're not including women like Fannie Lou Hamer, then you're the worth of pretty much the rest of what you're talking about, I think, is like very much, you know, yeah. And
but we still have very few, right? Actually, you know, there's a collection of her speeches, but I don't know that people really think of her as kind of one of the consummate intellectuals of the 20th century, despite the fact that you can collect, and like a man, you can collect her edited speeches and her writing, you know? So it's just really interesting. So I think that's a really great example of how, you know, even though there's been a tremendous amount of growth in Black history and Black intellectual history, there's still, you know, these kind of major blind spots, or still these kinds of very rigid understandings of who we constitute to be an intellectual.
Yeah, and that's why I think that doing this in an edited volume is so phenomenal, because I'll just say my personal stance in this, I love edited volumes. I had never really read much, you know, prior. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, gotta, you know, flip to different places. I'm like, it actually, to me, I read edited volumes so much quicker than, you know, regular chapter by chapter books, because, you know, if I'm not mistaken, pretty much every single essay is no more than I believe probably about 18 pages, give or take. And so it's relatively short, but it shows how much, you know, how much strength is, you know, in each blow of the essays here. And you know, especially as a scholar of slavery, you know, Black radicalism, I was waiting to see the one, the essay that was about enslaved groups. And so I saw Dr. Gregory Childs, his essay, Conspiracies, Seditions, Rebellions, Concepts and Categories in the Study of Slave Resistance. And I was like, oh snap. I could already tell from that title that thing is about to be a banger. And most certainly, like every single contributor, Dr. Childs and everyone else did not let us down. And so with that as well, do you mind talking with us a bit about your contribution, Becoming African Women, Women's Cultural Nationalist Theorizing in the U.S. Organization, or the US Organization and the Committee for Unified Newark?
Yeah, certainly. And I just, before we get to that too, I think you brought up a very good point about, or, you know, you hit on one of the things we were trying to do. You know, most people, when they think about radicalism, they think of, you know, the late 20th century. So each of the sections really does have a broad kind of temporal frame, with the goal of understanding that how black people over time have dealt with a particular idea or issue, you know, not just when they were enslaved, not just, you know, in the late 20th century. So for my section, it is a study of black women who were part of Kawaitist organizations. Kawaita is a version of cultural nationalism that functions very basically on the idea that we need a cultural revolution before a political one, or that African Americans need to kind of rid themselves of, you know, the holidays, the dress, the hair, the practices that have become kind of white cult capitalist culture, in an effort to kind of prepare oneself for the political revolution. It was a very popular philosophy, a very popular ideology in the 1960s and 70s. Most people have probably encountered the ideology through the holiday of Kwanzaa, which was created by the US organization founder, Milana Karanga, who's also kind of the chief architect of Kawaita as a philosophy, and it has a whole intellectual tradition in and of itself. But one of the things that often happens in these particularly cultural nationalist organizations is they're written off. They're written off for two reasons. The first is most people kind of think these performances of holidays or changing one's name or changing one's dress were not considered as real or as deep political engagement. And the second is that they did, at least at the very outset of these organizations, have very, very conservative gender politics that have given them a bad rap. Now, without negating any of those issues or kind of questioning the validity of both of those things, my goal in the chapter is really to, you know, just take people's ideas seriously on their own terms. You know, my argument here is that we don't get to cast out a whole group of people, in this case, in the Black Power movement, which I study, simply because, you know, that their ideas may seem not in line with what we would think right now. So the goal of the chapter is really to talk about the women who were part of these organizations. You know, whether they had regressive gender politics or not, thousands of women joined between the CFUN and US organization and found it to be a really viable way to practice Black politics and Black power. So the article kind of talks about, the book chapter kind of talks about these women, why they were drawn to the organization, what it did for them, but also reads their intellectual productions, such as their handbooks or such as their kind of women's columns, to talk about the ways in which they made the philosophy their own and the ways in which they pushed back at the kind of conservative gender politics of the group. And what I argue is that we should take both these groups and these women seriously in their own rights, but also think of these organizations and contestations over gender roles within these organizations as a dynamic conversation within Black intellectual history.
Great. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I've really, really enjoyed learning. I just love all your work because, you know, I remember emailing you about a year ago. And so talking about, you know, Black nationalist thought and also looking at like the 19th century versions of that. And it's really interesting because, you know, your work and the work, the reason why we came together last year from Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, you know, all of these bits are just so, you know, important for all of us because, you know, you of all are so great at, you know, uncovering, uncovering for those of the uninitiated, I would say, you know, these phenomenal Black women intellectuals and providing a phenomenal interpretation of their work and how they work to create the world that we're in today. And also thinking about what their thoughts of what, you know, revolution and what their thoughts of community were/are, because, you know, obviously many of the people that you write about are still alive today.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, it's exciting when you uncover these kind of dynamic conversations. It's exciting to see. I would say intellectual history is very generative in that way. You know, when you're really primed to look at it and kind of get out of your mind that it's supposed to look a certain kind of way, you really can find some really interesting conversations about all the different ways, you know, Black folk were trying to just not only just get from day to day, but also support each other and also, you know, theorize liberation. I mean, you know, for Black people in particular, you're kind of constantly engaging in thought projects about liberation because it hasn't arrived yet. So I think that's why intellectual history is not only so generative, but also a really important history to, you know, kind of record and lift up.
Right. And I remember, like, I was having a conversation, I was having a thought about this in one of my seminars. I won't tell you which one, but I was in a seminar recently, and a thought came to me. I think we were probably talking about intellectualism or something, and I had mentioned how probably, like, I would say a couple years ago, if you asked me what an intellectual would look like, it would be someone wearing all Black with a turtleneck and like glasses in like a Starbucks or like some like some like coffee shop, you know, that may or may not be in Austin, Texas. And like, it'd be thinking like, you know, that's what, you know, that's what an intellectual looks like. God knows I'm so glad that I have run away from that notion of what it, you know, what an intellectual looks like, what kind of production, what does production for an intellectual look like? And I would say I've been changed, and I know many of my other colleagues as well have been changed because of your work and the work of AAIHS, which is also interesting on a side note, because I remember when I think it was somebody at the conference this past year, and you know, they were trying to, like, AAIHS kept on going, and it's a hard you know, acronym to say out in a speech. Yeah. Or
not our best quoting point.
Right, you know, and it's an exercise. And as well, I think it was, you know, it's so interesting too, like, thinking back at that conference, right? That was my first, you know, formal introduction to the group. And, you know, we have in our midst as the keynote speaker the 2019 iteration is going to be Dr. Eula Taylor. This past year we had Dr. Barbara Ransby. You know, one of the things that I found was that one of the most important things that she said was in her keynote was, I think, something to the degree of, you have to find your people. You know, you have to find your people. And I think that, you know, AIHS is a place where I found my people. I found you know, fun graduate students. I found, I found, Dr. Blaine, she and I had lunch, that weekend at Brandeis. And right. And so like, those are the types of things, those are the type of, bits that, on a day that I randomly was at Publix in here in Winter Park, Florida, and I saw a friend from elementary school. I'd known her for 22 years. I remember those particular moments of our upbringing. But it's also interesting too how I speak to you, and I'm always going to remember those moments, like, with Dr. Blaine or going to Dr. Cameron's talk or to his him delivering his paper, or seeing you, I guess now 8 or 9 days ago, in Los Angeles, right? So those are the types of moments that I think are so important, because those are the ones that people remember, right?
Yes. Yeah, and I really think you hit on, kind of what Chris really envisioned in creating this space, and in some ways, the ways in which, the community has just made it into a thing of their own. When it started out, we were just looking for a space for people to try out their ideas, for people to come together in conferences, and it really has, because it's such a rich community, because people are so generative, because people are so collaborative, and I really think because people are all on the junior side, and when the most senior folks in the organization and or the conference are folks that are only a couple of years in on the tenure track, I think we have a different orientation, a kind of collaboration and helping out, I think it shows in the experiences that folks have at the conferences, and in kind of the diversity of people willing to write for the blog, because I think people are starting to reckon with the fact, but people, I think, really underestimate what a time commitment, how much skill blogging takes. And people's willingness to become regular bloggers when we ask, I think, is because I hope they feel like they're getting, both an online and offline community in response, and really quite a wide readership of their ideas, which is great at any level. You don't want to work really hard researching and writing something, if you don't want to share it with the world.
Yeah. And it's so wild. Like, I've been the last year, being with New Books and African American Studies, and then now writing for Black Perspectives, it has been wild when people come up to me and they're like, yeah, I really liked, your piece in such and such time. And I'm like, oh, snap. Like, wow.
Yeah, it has a really wide readership. You will find that it really does, and because it's written in an accessible form, it's not behind a paywall. It really does capture a lot of people's attention, and it can, and done well, which I think Black Perspective does. It really can be an entry point for people both inside and outside of the academy to just get in, learn more about a part of history that they're interested in.
Yeah, and on a more somber note, I remember, my grandmother, she recently passed, and I remember my uncle telling me that, one of the last things that she actually read was my review of Dr. Martha Jones's Birthright Citizens, a History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America, I believe. And so, that's the type of thing that I think is so important, because my grandmother would not have been able to read that or have it read to her if not for this lack of a paywall, which to a certain degree goes into, one of our next conversations, I hope, later on, which will be about your like what I told you at ABWH was your Archiving While Black article from, I believe it was originally published in Black Perspectives, right? And so then I think it was a Chronicle that picked it up or reposted it. And so I thought, like I said to you in person, like, that I think was one of the most important pieces of writing published in all of 2018, because to produce work like New Perspectives on the Black intellectual tradition in some way, shape, or form, you're probably going to have to engage in some archival work, whether digitally or in person. And many times you have, even today, right, you still have to, you know, go through this bit of, you know, face, right? That this, and to give you an example, like even earlier today, I was at Publix once more, and I had a woman ask me, you know, I'm wearing, you know, I went to Florida A&M University, you know, you're an HBCU grad as well, at Spelman. And so, we brag a little different like that, right? And so, I got my hoodie on, I got my sweats on, fam you down. And then, you know, this woman asked me, you know, I'm getting a sample of some meatballs, right? And she's like, oh, well, did you play football at, you know, I'll tell them where I went to high school, you know, did you play football there? And I'm like, no. And I was like, you know, or I played like, small level or whatever, junior varsity. And then, you know, she's like, oh, did you play football at FAMU? I was like, nah, I played rugby. And I was like, and I told her I've been getting a PhD in history. And so like those bits right there where, you know, I'm not going to say, I'm not going to get into the notion of like her being, you know, being, you know, mean about it or anything like that. But that kind of bit right there made me think about your article in the sense of that kind of interaction for some people can push them away from an archival space, right? And so this notion of archiving while Black, like driving while Black, like walking or, you know, drinking a bit of coffee or the many different ways of while Blacking, you know, archiving is definitely not left off of the discussion piece too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it certainly is, it affects a different part of the population and it, you know, is not as widespread, but it certainly, I don't think that you'll find any Black scholar or another scholar who identifies as a scholar of color not feel, you know, somewhat alien or, you know, alone when you go into these spaces, you know, and it extends from actually the little architecture of the space, you know, they don't think about all of the kind of artifacts or archives that are on display there and how people from different subject positions have to interpret those, but also, you know, kind of the idea that, you know, you weren't meant to be here, you weren't supposed to be here, you couldn't possibly know what you're doing when you get there. You know, I find that I've been to dozens of archives at this point, and I find that, you know, they walk me through the instructions in a way they don't walk, you know, the white man in front of me through the instructions. I'm like,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just like, okay. So I think, like you said, it puts people off. And if we're, you know, if we're really trying to create history, diversify history, both as a profession and just, you know, kind of what gets to be, you know, produced for public consumption writ large, then, you know, you have to think about the ways in which we're alienating people that might do some of this work.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And so with the amount of time that we have left, right, I'd love to talk more about some of your future work. And also, right, obviously you can tell by kind of like, you know, how AIHS and Black Perspectives is like peppered, you know, into all of this. Can you talk to us a bit, like I said before, as much as you can divulge, right, trade secrets, about, you know, we're talking about the intellectual tradition. So like that is about, you know, the past traditions and how, you know, scholars right now are engaging with the Black intellectual tradition. And so with that being said, in conjunction with the actual organization, and everything underneath it and everyone underneath it, can you tell us a bit about, you know, what do y'all think of as like the future of AIHS? What is the scholarly world that, you know, we're trying to build in this way? Right.
Oh man, that's a good question. I don't know that I have a lot of specifics for you, but I will say that, you know, we certainly hope that the organization keeps growing. We purposely keep the membership fee low of, now it's at $40, so that of diversity of people can join both, you know, just in the online community and have access to the grants and other stuff that we do, but also in the hopes that we'll draw in a broad audience for or a broad participation for the conference. So we hope to grow the membership. And with growing the membership typically means that the conference grows. You know, I think, I can't say for sure, but the 2020 conference will be in Austin, Texas. But we're now in talks, for example, of perhaps extending it to another day. which is, you know, a manifestation of interest in the conference, but also our hope to be able to provide a space, not just for traditional conference papers, but more workshops on professional development, you know, inviting presses and journals to help, you know, up and coming history scholars learn kind of the tricks of the trade, and just also commune in general. So, you know, from that standpoint, we hope it gets better. I think, you know, one of the things that we hope to see in the future are more AIHS publications, and that certainly will be the case for the next volume coming out, the next anthology, but also, you know, perhaps another form of publication, another form of print publication. I'm not quite sure what that would be yet, but we like the, or we're very interested in kind of the reciprocal relationship between the online, the conference, and then I guess what some people will call more traditional publication.
Very well then. And what's next for you as a scholar? You know, you're now at UT Austin and in a phenomenal bit. You know, you're between, if I'm not mistaken, African Diaspora Studies and also the History Department at UT. Shout out, you know, to all my UT folks, Dr. Barry, Dr. Michelani, and Dr. Joseph is you know, he's adjacent. He's a different. Oh my, there's so many. Look at that. There's so many people. It's hard to, you know, y'all are, you know, phenomenal down there. And so, you know, you have all those people down there, right? And so I'm very interested to know, right, what's next for you as a scholar?
That's a good question. I am finishing up a little bit of book touring in the spring based on remaking Black Power. And then I am turning my sights, I think, towards a new book, which I don't think I'm quite ready to divulge. But we'll still be, you know, in the similar vein of focused on Black women and Black intellectual history. I'm headed back to the archive to see what I can find. And I think that I am interested in kind of expanding, a little bit past Black Power, so doing more expansive history of Black women's intellectualism and Black radicalism, not just in the 60s and 70s, but, you know, taking a little bit back further to the early 20th.
Phenomenal. And, you know, Dr. Farmer, I really appreciate you being on the program today to talk about the phenomenal new book published by our friends at Northwestern University Press entitled New Perspectives on the Black Intellectual Tradition, edited by none other than an all-star team of scholars named Dr. Keisha N. Blaine, who teaches history at the University of Pittsburgh, and she's also the author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women in the Global Struggle for Freedom, and she's also the co-editor of the Charleston Syllabus, readings on race, racism, and racial violence, along with Dr. Christopher Cameron, who is an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and he's the author of To Plead Our Own Cause, African Americans in Massachusetts, and the making of the anti-slavery movement. And once again, folks, we've had the esteemed opportunity, y'all, twice in a full roundabout year with none other than our friend, Dr. Ashley D. Farmer, who is Assistant Professor of History and African Diaspora Studies at none other than UT Austin. And she is the author of, as she's mentioned before, the phenomenal book published by UNC Press, Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, which is none other than also the first comprehensive study of Black women's intellectual production and activism in the Black Power era. Though I am now almost out of breath, I am so glad that this particular opportunity came together. And Dr. Farmer, it's been a pleasure and honor. And we hope to have you back on New Books in African American Studies as soon as that, not going to be divulged, title book is going to be published as well.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much for taking the time to read the book and engage in kind of the process of making it and AIHS. We really, truly appreciate it.
No problem at all, folks. And once again, I am Adam McNeil, host of the channel, PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Delaware. New Books in African American Studies, folks, over and out.